1598-675, State Act Trail, Shweta, Caleb for Javier Workers' Compensation.
Says that there will be a state board. time that the state board, the duties of the state board will be: one, to collect; two, to administer; three, to distribute; and finally, to determine the rights of applicants under the law. Now, what right of the applicant am I talking about? She is getting medical treatment, it is being paid for, and all of a sudden, there is an organization, which is a private enterprise, that says, hey lady, we're cutting you off.
That was MCO that did that on their own.
Yes. I think they did it on their own in the belief that they were authorized to do it, but they did it. They did it in their mind, having been authorized by the state to act, carried out a state function.
That was my next question, if you get to that, the creation of the MCO. The state created the MCO, and is that a state agency with authority to do what it did?
I think that the authority as to what can be done is limited, in that what can be done must be done through the state fund and by the state administering. I think the state can make decisions. I read Michael versus Morris case to say that there can be more than one state agency. I do not read that case to say that private enterprise may take a part of what the government is supposed to be doing. I was going to explain that when you deal with Article 2, Section 35, we're dealing with something that was passed by the people in 1912. The argument back then was, could the state create a compulsory workers' compensation system? They created a voluntary system. The amendment, Article 2, Section 35, provided for a compulsory system. It did three things, I would submit. Number one, it recognized it would provide for a compulsory system. Number two, it wanted a system administered by the state. We're one of six states in the country that have an exclusive state fund. Insurers are not permitted to write workers' compensation insurance in the state of Ohio. And I think that was done because they wanted a uniform system. And I'm going to tell you in a second that what's happened now is it is not uniform. And I think they wanted it done also to eliminate the profit motive in workers' compensation. And that apparently has worked well. In the 1980s, when companies that were dealing in states where insurance could be written were raising premiums dramatically, in the state of Ohio, premiums were being dropped. And in this decade, there have been rebates to the employers or refunds to the employers. There have been reductions of premiums to the employers. And that's because, in part, there is no profit motive. What have we injected into this now? We have injected a profit motive, and we've done something else, which I think would be forbidden under corrugated container decision. In a corrugated container decision, this court ruled that money could not be transferred from a state insurance fund to the general revenue fund of the state to cover administrative costs of workers' compensation incurred by the state. And what are we doing here? We are transferring money from the state insurance fund to these MCOs, which are private enterprises, so that one, they can be paid, and two, so they can pay bills of medical providers. And I think that's prohibited.
And in that regard, Mr. Jaffe, you accurately point out that the whole underpinning of this is Article 2, Section 35, and in that first sentence, it also says, determining the terms and conditions upon which payment shall be made.
Yes, sir.
Why is not this a term and condition of how payment's going to be made?
I think it is not a term and condition because of the two limiting factors in Article 2, Section 35. One, that there will be a state fund, and two, that there will be a state board administered.
Well, the money is still being paid out of the state fund.
Money is coming out of the state fund.
All right, so that's the first qualifying factor. And the second?
It is not being administered by the state. When you take a look at what's happened with this MCO procedure, you will see, one, the MCO claims authority for terminating ongoing treatment. This is an administrative matter. It is a matter that cuts her off. And it cut her off.
Yeah, I understand the facts.
Number two, the provisions here provide that the MCO will approve medical bills in accordance with the standards of the MCO. Not the standards of the state, but the standards of the MCO.
Can't the state have agents?
If the state is not administering, I guess it doesn't matter what you call it.
Well, the state has set up a system that, for all intents and purposes, sometimes a district hearing officer, certainly a staff hearing officer's decisions become final.
That is correct.
Through their surrogates, if you will, the state being the amorphous, unclutchable entity. Why not MCOs, too?
The commission, through its hearing officers, makes decisions, and they are employed by the state. And there is no profit motive in what they do, and there's no incentive on them to do what they do other than to decide, theoretically at least, in accordance with what the law provides.
Are the doctors that the commission sends you to employees of the state?
No.
They're independent contractors. They're independent contractors.
But no one significant difference. Those doctors don't make the decision. Those doctors do an evaluation and a report. And they send that report to the Bureau. And somebody in the state agency will act on that report. But it is not the doctor making the decision. It is not the MCO authorizing treatment according to standards of the MCO. And what do we have? We have a set of uniformity. We have 51 different kinds of standards. Talk about prior authorization. We have 51 different approaches to prior authorization.
Would you complain if the MCO did what it did here, but that there would be required a hearing, notice and a hearing, because those are your two issues in your brief, notice and hearing before there's a termination?
I think there would be a difference if there was notice and hearing. However, the way this is set up, I do not believe the state is administering, and that to me is the primary criteria.
So in other words, it could never be, regardless of notice or hearing, which are your two major points, MCOs are just verboten.
I would say that private enterprise is verboten, and I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for
After I ask you a question, Mr. Jaffe, the respondents argue that the self-insured system is somewhat analogous to this, and you've argued. I'd like to hear your strongest response to that.
I would submit to you that it is not really analogous because in the creation of this system, it was recognized that self-insurance was permitted. And secondly, the difference is the self-insured are not issuing the decision. There is no time limit for which an appeal must be filed.
But they do deny benefits.
What they do is what any debtor does. They either pay or they decide that they're not going to approve payment, and then the claimant has to file to get a hearing at the Industrial Commission.
Go ahead. Ask you later.
I think it's wise, Mr. Jeff, if you respond to a question from the Justice. I'll give you a little time, but you might want to respond to a question any of us asks before you sit down. That's just a tip. You can sit down if you want to. But
I don't mean to offend the Justice.
You're not offending me, but I think you might want to answer the question regarding the recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court and how you would distinguish that. American manufacturers.
I think it's very simple. It is the state of Pennsylvania. They have a system that is not an active system. They have a system where the state has passed the law. And really what's happened there is that different private insurance companies are following that law. I read that Supreme Court decision basically to say Pennsylvania is not an active participant. And that is how I distinguish that case. And I will stop. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jaffe. Mr. Hustad.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm representing the Bureau of Workers' Compensation. I have Chaplain Tables, Mike Hanger, representing Anthem, and James Barnes, representing the Industrial Commission. I will reserve time for those two gentlemen also. Approximately 5 minutes.
You need to watch your time closely if you're going to reserve for two other
people. I will. Thank you. The Health Partnership Program is statutorily mandated. Now, there's a strong presumption that all Catholics and assemblies are constitutional. The presumption presumption of constitutionality may be overcome only by proof beyond a reasonable doubt that the legislation and constitutional provisions are clearer in comparison. The citizens of this state deserve a first-class workers' compensation system.
Well, they do deserve that, but it has to be in compliance with the Constitution. And how are these MCOs a part of the state? How is an MCO a branch of the state?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it's really, I'm characterizing it as a branch of the state. I don't think this.
Well, under the Constitution, doesn't have to be in order to be compliant.
I don't think so, Your Honor. If you read Section 2, Article 35, it's remarkable for how little it says. Very remarkable. It was written a long time ago. It was written, I believe, to give tremendous flexibility to the General Assembly.
It must be administered by the state?
Your Honor, it says that laws may be passed establishing a state fund and administered by the state. That is exactly what we have here. The state fund is being administered by the state.
Through a private enterprise.
Well, the state is utilizing private entities to make initial medical determinations. That is all that's happening here. It's really no different from the state. And almost every medical question we've had over the years, whether it be permanent total disability or impairment, temporary total, permanent partial awards, any awards like that, the state of Ohio has had to defer and go out and go to medical experts and say, well, what do you think on this? Is this person capable of sustained remunerative employment? Those are independent contractors. They're not state employees. And that's been done for a long time. Self-insured employers make these determinations, and they always have.
Always subject to review.
Pardon?
It's always subject to review by the Bureau of the Commission.
To make the ultimate decision. Here, the MCO just cuts it off.
No, Your Honor, that's right.
Before a hearing?
Well, before a hearing, and my position is, and I think it's very clear, the Sullivan case clearly puts the due process arguments to rest. That case, the lower court decision in that case was relied upon by me, Guy, and Relator. They were pointing that decision when it was in their favor. The Supreme Court reversed that and held now that there is no denial of due process for this pre-deprivation of medical reimbursement.
Counselor, let me ask you this question, because this case is really a major case that's before us now. It's going to affect a lot of issues and people. We've continually heard, of course, that privatization in government is the answer, because private enterprise can do things more cost-effective than can employees of a city or a state, for instance, clean buildings. What if the General Assembly decided, or the Bureau of Workers' Compensation, or the Industrial Committee, the Bureau of Workers' Compensation, decided to take this $16 billion, $18 billion fund, whatever it's up to now, and say, we got a lot of people here administering this, and we can save a lot of money. So we're going to choose, for lack of a better company, Gates McDonald, and we're going to turn over all the money to you, and you'll administer the fund, but we are going to supervise your administration. That'd be okay?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that's okay.
Why?
Because I think that's an extreme situation that you're causing there, and I think then you cross the line. The state is not then administering the state insurance fund.
Oh, yeah.
There's no MCO, Your Honor, that can take money out of the state insurance fund.
Well, but the money is still in the name of the state insurance fund. They can't transfer the funds. They can only transfer the administration of it and say, okay, and then we'll pay the bills as you administer it.
Your Honor,
and it may be extreme. And maybe I chose it to be extreme, but isn't the legal theory the same?
I really don't think so, Your Honor. I think, you know, what you have here in our particular situation, in this particular situation, is the Bureau, after being mandated to do so by the state, pursuant to statutes which are in total compliance with this very brief section of the Constitution, has decided to utilize certain private entities to make initial medical determinations. Every one of those determinations can can be appealed to the Bureau, and then the district hearing officer, the staff hearing officer, the commission, and that's exactly what happened here.
But the problem is, I'm sorry.
The person is cut off in
yeah, that's the problem.
Period.
And that's always been the case, Your Honor. Before HTP, if the Bureau, if they gotten 33 chiropractic bills for a 5-month period, which is what happened here, and saw that it wasn't being affected, this person had been going on chiropractic treatment for 4 years at this point, and they decided this is not helping this person, we are not going to pay for this anymore, they would then send a letter out saying we're not paying for this anymore, and then that person could go up to the appeals process. Now at least they have an ADR system, some kind of informal way of resolving these problems.
Meantime, the bills are not being paid.
It's not that voluntary either. It's something that keeps a lot of people out of this staff hearing officer, district hearing officer, and administrative those kinds of proceedings because their problems get worked out initially, early on in the process by this ADR process. That the statistics show that a big percentage, the majority, have their problems worked out without having to file an appeal with the district hearing officer or the staff hearing officer. That is beneficial. That's why this system is so good. That's why it's so important that this system be left in place. Yes?
In the system that exists before this, the Bureau could terminate their benefits and then they would have the right to appeal, or they had to.
That's my question.
They can terminate the benefits and then go up on appeal. Even if the Bureau decided we're not paying for any more benefits.
Yeah, and the bills are not paid. The time to get your appeal done is 2 years.
That's correct. Just look at the self-insured employers, too. There's 3 hearings, termination. Then the individual, even the waste.
No, it's not a hearing.
Medical benefits reimbursement is treated differently than compensation. It always has been. And that is the scenario. The person goes up to the district hearing officer. The district hearing officer says, claimant, you're right. We think you should be reimbursed for that. They don't get reimbursed for that until the staff hearing officer, if there's an appeal, agrees with that. Only then will those benefits get reimbursed.
So if we found the system unconstitutional and the old system were back in place, there would still be pre-hearing termination benefits.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's been the case. As I was saying, the citizens of the state deserve a first-class workers' compensation system. And by citizens, I mean employers, employees, and they've got the people on the street whose voices are heard only through their elected officials in the General Assembly. Ohio now has that first-class workers' compensation system. Overall, although nothing's perfect, it is a good system. Overall, it helps more people than it hurts. And there is no denial of due process. The Sullivan case, I don't care what state it's from, but it clearly says that this deprivation of benefits before a hearing and notice, in this particular situation for medical benefits reimbursement, is okay and not a problem. There's no denial of
How can you say that it helps more people than it hurts when the benefits are cut off without a hearing and that the benefits do not continue until a hearing some months later? How can you say it helps more than it hurts?
Because, Your Honor, I think the majority of folks in those situations are resolving that type of problem in the ADR process before having to go to the Bureau or the Industrial Commission, whose time periods used to be before the system. If the Bureau cuts you off, there weren't these strict time periods that we have now. It took a lot longer to get those issues resolved and get up to the staff hearing officer.
You had your payments cut off without a hearing?
Yes, Your Honor. If the Bureau disputed some kind of medical benefits reimbursement, that's what was done. And in this situation, the ADR helps people more than hurts them because it allows them, first of all, they don't necessarily have to get a lawyer to have a hearing. There's no full-blown hearing. It's worked out amongst medical professionals, and people are allowed to get done informally, and the statistics show that the majority of them do.
Are medical benefits different than permanent partial disability, for instance, or temporary total, let's say temporary total?
It's treated differently, Your Honor.
Because we have specifically said, and I think everybody agrees, you got to have a hearing before you can terminate those.
And they are treated differently, Your Honor. Just as I just stated, it's not to, and that issue is not until the staff hearing officer that rules in your favor. Even if the DHO has, it's not until the staff hearing officer does that the medical reimbursement is begun. So it's definitely different. I think Justice Rehnquist and Sullivan points that difference out too, the difference between compensation and ongoing medical treatment. There is no property right to ongoing medical treatment of a specific type, like chiropractic treatment. And that's another item I just before I sit down, I want to point out.
Well, what if the medical treatment was life sustaining? Still no right to.
According to the U.S. Supreme Court, no, Your Honor. I mean,
controls.
I think there might be some emergency provisions.
I think the U.S. Supreme Court decision controls this issue for certain.
I think it does as far as the due process issue goes, Your Honor.
And we're talking.
I'd also like to point out that when the MCO sent out the letter denying the benefit, the MCO, they did not deny all benefits. They denied further chiropractic treatment, and at the same time sent a letter to the claimant saying, to the claimant stopper saying, here are some other alternatives, including going to a neurosurgeon for diagnostic testing, because maybe you have other problems, and maybe there are other conditions at work here, and that may help the claimant have 4 years of chiropractic. That's perfectly reasonable.
Okay. I want to pursue before you sit down. Fact pattern here.
Excuse me, opposed to
it's a good case for you to argue the right things to be done for the but it is the provision of oxygen, and that may not be a good example for someone who has a serious lung problem that is
kids sure dress different than what I'm used to. I spoke to my grandson's third grade class last Friday. It was career day, show and tell grandpa day. And the boy came out and said, "Mom, put you and your grandson." I walked into his class, called him up and thanked him.
They can terminate benefits without a hearing, and then they would have to appeal up to the hearing officer. There's precedence for this system the way it is right now.
Thank you, Mr. Bader, Mr. Panther.
Thank you, Your Honors. The only thing that really is an issue here is that the legislature provides a better system for determining medical necessity claims. It has always been the case that where the Bureau felt a claim was inappropriate, that it would simply terminate payments and you could take an appeal to the Industrial Commission. All this does is put on the front end of that a more effective mechanism. And that is the concern here of our opponents, is that now we have a mechanism that can really medically manage claims. And the question was asked, why do we know this is how? 70% of all claims that have come through the system thus far have been resolved within the dispute resolution process, which means that once the issue is raised, the treating physician, the claimant, the MCO have been able to agree upon a more effective treatment modality. And that's what this is all about.
I guess that's my question. I thought when this legislation was adopted that it was the purpose of it was to move the claims more quickly, which theoretically would benefit claimants. They would, most of them get treatment, and so they get their treatment approved more quickly than the old system where paper backs up on the desk of some bureaucrat to put it in less time. And so the General Assembly decided to permit the private sector to help manage the claim. That, and now, do we have in the record? I didn't see attachment, but in the record, is there evidence of what you just said that the claims that the DNO stated in the briefs that this the system has worked, albeit not for Mr. Jaffe's client theoretically, but generally has the system worked? Do we have data that indicates that?
We do have data. A study was done and it showed that 70% of the claims are resolved within the very expeditious ADR process. of the MCO, which means those claimants walk away without a dispute and with better care. Now, in the case of Mr. Jaffe's own client,
what does that actually know? Counsel, is that, I don't know you specifically, but 70% of the disputes resolved, does it necessarily follow that the claim walked away with better care? Is that what the study found also?
Well, I did 70% of it. It found that 70% did not proceed to the Bureau for appeal or to the...
Did you do an analysis of the quality of care?
Well, let me explain why I infer that the quality of care is better. And this is a perfect example. This woman, the claimant in this case, received 33 chiropractic treatments over a 5-month period without any benefit. She was seen by 3 medical physicians, 2 specialists, 1 orthopedist and 1 urologist.
That's she was seen by... My question is, the study that you just passed off to us as meaning that quality of care was better, did it really analyze quality of care? That's all I'm asking. You represented it. It did.
I think it did. And the reason I say it is because if the treating physician of a particular claimant and the claimant were not happy with the resolution that was arrived at.
So you brought in and right state, you know, people then to appeal and say we can infer quality of care. I mean, I don't see how that problem. I mean, that's way off the track what we hear about.
Well, what we hear about is making sure that patients, that claimants are cured, get better, return to the workplace.
Interesting.
And what we see in this very case
claimants.
Is a person who was continuing to suffer and was receiving unnecessary care. There's no dispute about that.
Or in this case.
What we really care about is whether the MCOs comply with the Constitution.
Yes, ma'am. And, Madam Justice, let me explain. The Sullivan case articulated the reasons why there should be...
You're all citing the Sullivan case. Is the Pennsylvania Constitution identical to Article 2, Section 35 of the Ohio Constitution?
It is not, but in critical aspect, the case
it is not. It is not.
And the reason it does is because the Pennsylvania statute requires that medical care be reasonable and necessary. And in the Miller decision, this court said the same thing is true in Ohio, that medical care must be reasonable and necessary. And the Sullivan case said that, A, you've got to establish liability on the part of the employer. There's no question about that. And two, you've got to establish care is reasonable and necessary.
So before we get all of that, Article 2, Section 35 requires that the program be administered by the state. And perhaps Mr. Barnes is going to address that. I haven't heard anybody really address that from your side.
The word administration is a very large word.
Yeah.
And the state...
Broad, too.
Hire medical experts, retain medical experts and consultants, use banks to disperse funds, give banks instructions on dispersing funds. This is no different. And the Sullivan case addressed that as well and said that if the state does not coerce or direct the decision and the actor is left to his own discretion, then the actor is not a state actor. And that's true here too. Anthem reached the decision that the claim should be cut off. That was then recommended to the state, but wasn't resolved. There was no final decision without the consent of the claimant.
That's the payments
if the claimant didn't agree with the outcome, it then went into the state agency for a final decision, as it always has. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Kanter. Respondents are well over their time, but Mr. Burns, you may take a minute.
Yes, sir. May it please the court, counsel. I'm here representing the Industrial Commission of Ohio and the Center for Workers' Compensation. My sole purpose of being here this morning is to reiterate that the reemphasize that the Industrial Commission is not a proper party to this action. As far as the commission is concerned, we will later have to see everything which she has asked for. And there's nothing for the court to compel the Industrial Commission to perform. The Industrial Commission is not part of the ADR process. The commission's role is triggered when there is an appeal from a final bureau decision under 4123.511C, and whether the ADA, whether the ADR process exists or not, the industrial commission is responsible for hearing appeals from final bureau orders, as it did in this case.
Who spells out the ADR process?
The bureau.
The bureau establishes.
Yes, the bureau establishes the parameters, which the COs are required.
And there's no oversight by the commission on whether or not that process.
There is absolutely no oversight. And for the reasons that.
And no statutory power for the oversight.
Exactly. And for the reasons were fully set forth in the commission's motion for summary judgment filed in September 16th of '98, the commission respectfully requested it be dismissed from the
session. Who administers the first cutoff?
The MCO?
The
state?
Yes, the MCOs under the authority of the state.
Under the authority, but it's not part of the state. The initial cutoff is the MCO, not the state.
It's an initial determination where the state has final.
The state has no input into the initial cutoff, do they?
No, that's the.
The MCO does.
This is designed for the claimant's position. To get together.
It's strictly up to the MCO to make the cutoff. It's not the state has nothing to do with it.
After consultation with the physicians involved.
I'm trying to see whether or not the state has any input whatsoever in the initial cutoff, and you said no.
There is no direct input. No.
Well, direct or indirect, they have nothing to do with the initial cutoff. Is that correct?
There is no input for the initial.
Thank you. Thank you.
Before you say that, the figure was thrown out that 70% don't go beyond the ADR process.
Who's your answer?
Is that right?
You don't have to answer that.
I'm not sure. I'm wondering.
The initial determination is made by the MCO. Can you stop that? I wish that for you too.
Well, I don't think that we'll ever get to 100%, and the program is continuing.
It's impossible.
So it's true, and I fully expect that there will be a further increase.
Thank God.
Thank you, Mr. Barnes. Mr. Jaffe, you saved over 2 minutes of your time, but you'll have extra time since it's time to consider the time. I'd like to start you with a question. The term administered by the state certainly is a very general, broad term. And I guess I'm wondering, the Bureau, I think still, I'm sure still has hires an investment company or advisors to determine what to do with the vast amount of money that comes in through the premiums. Does this language restrict the Bureau's authority to hire investment counselors or not?
The Bureau makes the decisions that they have.
Does the Bureau make the decisions that all transactions that are
Bureau,
made before they're made?
I don't want to get into the financial aspect here because...
Well, we're talking about the Constitution. The language either applies or doesn't apply.
No. The Bureau is entitled to employ assistance. It gets assistance from financial advisors. The Bureau is not only responsible for what they do, but they actually administer what it is that is done.
So the Bureau, you're urging that the Bureau hires, say, Merrill Lynch to manage a part of its investment account. You're saying that the Bureau has people, state employees, who actually determine what investments are to be made, what transactions, when to buy, sell.
Let me shortcut and say, one, it's not the issue here, and two, the Bureau gets assistance, and I'm not arguing that they can't get assistance from financial advisors. I am arguing that the state constitution requires And the third sentence of that state constitution, I think, very clearly says the state will administer, the state is to determine the rights of claims on applications. And what do we have here? We have a non-state entity making a determination. One of the things that was said to you by people on the other side was there is no property right here, and the Sullivan case tells you that. We'll talk a moment or two about Sullivan. Sullivan clearly says the exact opposite. There is a property right here. And it cites the Goldberg case, and it cites the Matthews versus Eldridge case. And what it says essentially is, in both those cases, there is a statutorily created benefit. And what we have here is a constitutionally created benefit and a statutorily created benefit. That's what we have. So there is a property right. This woman was receiving treatment.
I'm looking at the syllabus, though. I'm looking at the syllabus of the case, and in the syllabus, the court does find that there's no deprivation of a property interest because under the second prong, that these treatments weren't met reasonable and necessary.
I think it's because the state is not involved.
Okay, that's a different.
What they've done is to create a situation where Pennsylvania is a passive, non-participant. Will.
The whole state is, action issue.
Yeah,
right.
There is, but Ohio is different. For close to 90 years, Ohio under the Constitution has been an active participant. This is an active system. The state administers it, the state runs it. And all of a sudden, we have people making decisions, and you heard the people on the other side say, but it's not a final decision. It's clearly final for the period of time that the benefits are disrupted. It's clear.
But counsel, isn't it, when you say the benefits are disrupted, really, when we are speaking not of compensation, but we're speaking of reimbursement of medical payments to a health care provider, in this case a chiropractor, it's not, I mean, it sounds a lot worse to say medical benefits or oxygen or these sort of things. I mean, one would hope that these healthcare providers are continuing to provide for some time for anybody. It's just they're not getting reimbursed. Really, at some point they may when there's a hearing, but they won't be reimbursed in the regular course until.
What happened here was that this woman, apparently a believer that if you can't pay for it, you're not going to take advantage of it. Stop getting treatment.
Right.
When in fact her condition worsened and she went back to the doctor because that was the only recourse that she had, the doctor very kindly provided that treatment.
Right.
There are doctors who won't undertake a workers' compensation case in Ohio because of what has happened here.
I'm sure practicalities.
When you hear about the statistics, 70% supposedly are resolved in the dispute resolution process, I ought to say to you and remind you that we have people who are not represented, we have people who are illiterate, we have people who don't understand, and they get a letter, and the letter says we've terminated whatever, and they don't do anything with it. And that becomes a final decision. Yes, ma'am.
Under the old system, are the sentence correct that zero defendants will
I think they're partially correct and partially wrong. What was going on before the MCO process got underway was there were some places, some claims, where the Bureau proceeded to send the matter to the Commission for determination. There are other cases where the Bureau would terminate treatment, at least the same thing that happened here. If you look to the letter that is in the stipulated evidence, when the Bureau acknowledges the receipt of the appeal to the Bureau, you will see that it says the Bureau will either issue a decision or will forward this matter to the Industrial Commission for a decision. Under the old system, the Bureau terminated. I don't know that they had their right. Let me explain to this inspection. When you look to Senate Bill 222 back in 1989, there was an effort clearly made to delineate and distinguish the jurisdiction of these two agencies. And the effort was made to take away adjudicatory functions from the Bureau to make the Industrial Commission responsible for adjudicatory functions.
I think I'm going to live that
long. Until, and that was basically the vision, until 1993, at which point in 1993 the legislature gave back to the Bureau some limited adjudicatory jurisdiction on initial allowances of claims. There is nothing to indicate that they gave back dispute resolution on anything else, whether it is compensation or whether in fact it is medical benefits. That's essentially what happened here.
Councilor, two things. First, the indication was that there is this dispute resolution path, and that seems to be about 70%.
That's a closer question.
Was there a dispute resolution in the path on the old law? Or do you have a sense of how many terminations without going to the issue, or what percentage of those were being appealed?
I have no sense of what was being appealed. My only sense coming from today's experience, very frankly, is we spend more and more time going to the commission arguing about medical benefits, much more than we ever used to do. I also point out,
and the second one is, mechanically, is there any opportunity for an MCO, if they desire to do so, to say, this is a tough call. We think it probably should be terminated, but we're not sure. So let's refer this to the commission for hearing and determination. In other words, if they want to, some extent, reasonable minds could differ. Let's get a hearing. Is there any opportunity for that?
Let me talk for a moment about the dispute resolution procedure and the procedures I would understand. Number one, the MCO has no authority to, if you will, cast the ball. They're there to make a decision. One of the responsibilities clearly by statute is cost containment. That means that they have got to shut down on costs. You then have an agency.
And there's nothing really wrong with the
going through
files and saying it looks like this provider is an absolute charlatan, it's working the system.
Well, there are, if you please, there are two other ways to get at this charlatan. One, the statutes themselves permit the Bureau to get at the charlatan. The statutes themselves permit the Bureau to remove a charlatan, if you will. That's what the Bureau can do. In addition to that, the MCO has authority under, I think it's 6-032F, to sanction and terminate medical providers. And I think that tells you, one, they could do it. It also tells you they are administering. But the point I'd really like to make in connection with this dispute resolution process, which needs to be understood, is that the MCOs are paid an incentive payment. You'll find that in 6-13 of the code, and I believe it is in point 44 of the statute, an incentive payment for performance, which means that they are encouraged, if you will, to terminate. When they talk to you about quality care, two of the doctors who reviewed this case, Dr. Blank and Dr. Connolly, both suggested that this lady ought to be referred to a pain management consultant. Did the MCO do that? Did they suggest it? No, none of that happened. So I think it's nice to talk about the quality of care being improved, but the facts of the case demonstrate that that is not the situation. But again, if you talk about the dispute resolution, you look to see that the MCO is a participant in the dispute resolution procedure. 6-16, in effect, makes them a party. So that you've got a party that is supposedly hearing an appeal and resolving it. And you've got to figure out if the party is going to resolve it in its own favor. I don't know of an ADR procedure, which is what they claim they've done. I don't know of an ADR procedure that says you can have a biased party making that, if you will, resolution, suggesting the resolution to parties. The MCOs are biased because they get the incentive performance. The MCOs are biased because they are parties to the proceedings.
You take your time, yes.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The next case is...
Is there something up there?